In 2015, I was visited by an FBI agent that walked into the office and said, "I'm looking for Tom Kirkham." And he says, "You're in trouble, but it's not with us." And he began to tell me that I am named on an ISIS kill list.
Welcome to the Happy Engineer Podcast, the place where we help engineers to build your career, balance your life, and be happy. My name is Zach White, a former engineer now turned CEO, lifestyle engineering coach, and your host. I believe that success without fulfillment is failure. Join me each week as we bring you an inspiring leader or message to help you enjoy both. Thanks for investing time with me today. Now let's do this. It's another ordinary day at the office, or sitting comfortably in your home office, when suddenly, the FBI comes knocking at your door. The agent says, "Excuse me, we need to talk. You're in big trouble, but not with us. Your name and personal details have been found on an ISIS kill list, and you need to take action to protect yourself and your family immediately." How did this happen? A cybersecurity data breach. And you're just the unlucky one. In this conversation, you will hear a gripping story and get a powerful lesson in technology and life from Tom Kirkham. Tom is the founder and CEO of Iron Tech Security. After receiving life-altering news from the FBI and taking a multi-year sabbatical to get off the grid and figure out his new life, he is now on a mission to protect companies and individuals from cyber attacks. There are thousands and thousands of cyber attacks on America every single day, and the vast majority of those attacks are not targeted. They're completely random, and you could become a victim. Every engineering leader who uses a computer needs to hear this one. That's you. And please share this with your colleagues and friends who work in other companies. We do talk tech and risk in this conversation. Full disclosure, Iron Tech provides cybersecurity defense systems and focuses on educating and encouraging organizations to establish a security-first environment. And hey, you would too if a data breach meant that you became a terrorist target. But this is not about marketing. It's about education and action for you and your corporation so that you don't underestimate the risk that we all face online. Hey, a quick reminder before we start. Join me online in the Happy Engineer community and get exclusive access to bonus content from this episode and live career coaching with me in our free group. The link to join is in the show notes. So just pause this for a moment, click the link, and join now. I'll see you there. All right. Welcome back, Happy Engineers. And Tom, so excited for our conversation today. Thanks for reaching out, for making time to be with me and all the Happy Engineers out there. Welcome to the show, man.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here, Zach. I am looking forward to this interview and picking each other's brains, and hopefully the listeners can find something to take home with them and think about.
I have no doubt about that. From the first communication we had, there's been more brain to pick than time to pick it, and I'm super excited about this and dig in. Tom, set the stage for us a bit. In the preview, we talked about your bio and your incredible experience and history with technology, with cybersecurity, and your company, Iron Tech Security. But can you just take us back to the beginning? What got you into this space? And maybe tell the story a bit of how we got to your expertise today.
Oh, wow. This is going to be interesting, especially since engineers have college degrees. But I went to college for economics.
Oh, hold on. We're going to have to cancel the interview, Tom. Economics. What? How is a cybersecurity guy an economic? I'm just kidding. That's interesting. So econ, where at?
Yeah. So economics, it made me a great macro investor. Okay. And so then the decades that I've been a nerd and been involved in technology and in either management or entrepreneurial or both, and we're talking about 40 years roughly, I specifically concentrated on the macro approach to investing in technology. So I went through the dot-com days, and to this day that I've dabbled in other markets and I am totally abysmal at it. But I have been very successful at technology investing. But My first real job was in management at a software company. So we had a whole, I managed teams of software engineers literally all over the world. In fact, one team was in Ukraine, in Kyiv. Now I had another team in Rochester, New York. And then I had a local team and a few others scattered here and there. But I was a designer. I wasn't a programmer. So it was my job to make the software visually appealing, easy to use, cut down the number, just make it really efficient for the user. So I got exposed real early on to the customer experience as they use the product and what's their hiccups, and really watching ways where I could identify things that need to be streamlined or things that need to be made more obvious. You know, it's about creating a good graphical user interface, right?
Yeah. And can you tell us what that first product was that you were designing?
It was retail management software. We were the first ones to even really think about putting it on the Windows platform. If that doesn't date me, I don't know what does.
That's
so
awesome.
So we were going into the we had a DOS product, but we were going into the industry on an international basis, and we had no competitors that were anywhere near where we were in actually putting it on the Windows platform. So I did a lot of speaking about, yeah, you need to move this way. And no, it already works on DOS. We don't need graphical user interfaces, right? Mm. And of course, obviously that didn't play out. But during that period of time, I won some awards from Microsoft for software design. Even though I wasn't an engineer, I didn't code.
Interesting.
And the dot-com days caused that company to basically lay off practically everyone, me included. So I started my own IT management services. You know, these days it's called a managed service provider.
Yes.
And then about 10 years ago is when I really started thinking about cybersecurity, because one of my quirkies is I have this interest in thinking like a criminal. You know, it's not like I want to be one. Like any good attorney knows how to bribe a jury, but they don't do it, right? That's what makes them a really good attorney. That's being able to think like that. And so I was always thinking about, how would I get away with robbing the bank across the street? Or how would I penetrate this company from a technology perspective? So I always had that knack. So I was driving our company to get more and more into security. And then in 2015, I was visited by an FBI agent that walked into the office and said, I'm looking for Tom Kirkham. I'm so-and-so with the FBI, held his badge up. And he says, you're in trouble, but it's not with us. And he began to tell me that I am named on an ISIS kill list. Now, you may remember around 2015, there were a number of ISIS kill lists that came out. Most of them were politicians, law enforcement, military, New York City, metro area, Washington, right? There was one list during that time that was random across the whole nation. And it was because of a data breach. An American in Georgia, Augusta, had breached this database. She had breached that database, and she was part of the United Cyber Caliphate, which is, at the time, was ISIS's National Security Administration, or U.S. Cyber Command. And they were highly skilled. But she sent that in and said, make this a new kill list. And so that's what they did.
Okay,
and
hold on.
It really increased my passion for going into cybersecurity.
No kidding. Just a little bit. Tom, take me to that moment. So you're just, it's like another day at work. You're in the office, not expecting this at all. And an FBI agent walks in the door, flashing their badge. What are you thinking initially in that moment? I mean, can you remember the first thing, like what happened right there in that?
Right. It was in July. I may have said May, but it was actually happened in July, and it was right around July 4th. And I can't remember what day of the week it fell on that year. It might have been a Saturday, and the whole office was closed except for me and one other person who is our president now. And it was just me and him. So, you know, it would have been, nobody would have believed me if I didn't have an eyewitness to all this stuff. But he comes in and he's going, yeah, and he's in a polo shirt and blue jeans. And he's like 30-ish, you know? Yeah, I would say it didn't really click. It didn't begin clicking until about 30 or 45 minutes into the discussion. And so I said, hey, I've never met an FBI. Can I look at your badge and, you know, and see all that again? You know, because I knew I had the right to, right? So, oh, yeah, sure. So I said it and I handed it back and we're just kind of, you know, what's the name of this caliphate thing and all of that? And so finally I said, so what does this mean? They're going to, you know, try to hack into my bank account or whatever. And he goes, no, they've designated you to be killed. They want you assassinated. Murdered. And that's when the gravity of the situation really sunk in. And of course, when you really start thinking about it, not only do you have personal protection, but you got to think anybody around you could become a possible target. So immediately I said, well, I've got to notify family and friends and colleagues that I'm on an ISIS kill list. And just understand that the likelihood of anything happening to me is extremely slim, right? And it's not like I got to worry about someone coming over from the Middle East to kill me. What they really were doing, one of the things they were doing, was recruiting lone wolves, other Americans that are sympathetic. They want to be a part of ISIS. And we just happened to have a couple living here in my town. And they eventually ended up getting arrested just before what I think was an imminent attack on a shopping mall. So I had to worry about that, you know, and so I didn't talk to anybody except those that needed to know for a couple of years.
Wow.
But I've survived it so far, and ISIS doesn't have nearly the power that they did, so I'm not too awful worried about it, but, you know, who knows? They may gain strength again someday. It was a pivotal moment.
Yes.
In my entire life, where it wakes you up to your mortality. I'd survived a couple of cancers, a spinal infection. And now I'm on an ISIS kill list. It was like the capper for what's been happening to me for the 3 years prior. And you really start reflecting, thinking about philosophical issues around mortality and the kind of life you want to lead and all of this. And so I spent a lot of time traveling around the world for probably a couple of years. And then I got more focused. And when I re-engaged with Iron Tech, I went back and joined the company. Fortunately, I'd put the right people in place while I was gone, did a fantastic job. And it allowed me to step back and quit being a network administrator or software designer or whatever it may be. And to really reflect, what do I want this culture to become? I want everyone to be happy. What kind of culture do I establish to where we don't have tension? No one hates to come in every day. Stress is minimized. I spent a lot of time thinking about that and reading management and leadership books and understanding the differences between a Steve Jobs and an Elon Musk.
I know the engineering leader listening is probably still reeling from the fact that the FBI barges in and Tom's on an ISIS kill list. So you don't hear this every day. But you mentioned this kind of 2 year window. You're in a time of deep exploration of your own mortality. You're traveling and sort of searching. I'm kind of curious, Tom, what were you really after during that time? Or what did you find or discover about yourself in the context of your own mortality during those 2 years? Is there anything that stands out as like, this is how that time changed me?
Purpose in life. How do I want to live the rest of my life where I can at least minimize the regrets? Every single person has regrets. You're in denial if you don't have regrets. And furthermore, if you don't learn from those regrets and minimize your mistakes, every day is about learning and growing as a human being. I continue to do that to this day. God knows I've got plenty of vulnerabilities and weaknesses and all of that. So one of the things about being a good manager and a good leader is identifying your own gaps. Audit yourself. You know, really, what are your strengths and weaknesses and other deficiencies? Because there's a very good chance you can add people to your team to complement those and to make that weakness as a leader a strength for the company that'll make it better for everyone.
Was there any moment, like you're traveling in the Himalayas or something happened where that purpose clicked or became really clear for you? And you mentioned you kind of came back with that renewed passion. Is there anything you remember during that window of time where you really felt purpose become clear and crystallized for you?
Wow. Jeez. That's a good question, man.
I think it became clear on my trip to Venice. I think I went to Barcelona and Venice on that trip. And I think the sheer beauty of Venice, and of course you get to marvel at the engineering of the bridge over the Grand Canal, Rialto, I think is what the name of it is, and just get marvel at that and how the city functions with, there's literally no cars on the island, there's no roads, and everywhere you walk, there's steps because you're walking across canals. So when you get off the bus at the north end of the island and your hotel is on the other side of the island, guess what? You're dragging your roll around walking up and down steps across canals probably 10 times just to get to the hotel. So it becomes a lot of work. And the people there fascinated me. They're from all walks of life. You can tell it's one of those places that is better off because of people from all over the world live there. And I love being in those environments. And those are special whenever you get a chance to be, you know, what you think, these are my people, right? Okay. You realize there's really no difference in people, but everyone knows what I'm saying. You know, there's a group, your group of friends, your peers you spend time with. You're on some sort of intellectual or spiritual connection, or you have common interests that you can talk about for hours. And I think it was right there. The short answer to your question, there was no specific thing that I had an aha moment. It was an evolution. I'm a slow learner. I'm one of these people that I learned from Elon Musk is to approach things from a first principle standpoint.
Yes.
And so because of that, and I never knew why I was a slow learner. I'm not joking about that. I'm a very slow learner. But it's because I always went back to first principles myself. I said, wait a minute, I don't understand why this is even relevant, you know, and on and on and on. So, you know, now I'm ended up back in philosophy from 3,000 years ago, right?
I love that, though. Yeah, just the willingness to have a non-linear path to your own learning and discovery. There's no flash bang purpose became crystal clear. It was just an evolution for you. I think it's good for people to hear. Sometimes we expect these brilliant aha moments. You hear testimonies from other, you know, amazing leaders on our show or other places, and it's like, oh, I haven't had that experience. And so it's really cool, Tom, to hear you say, you know what, it just required me to walk the journey a bit, and it happened. You know, I realized here it is. So maybe that's a good transition, Tom. You know, first principles, you came back with this renewed vigor around the importance of cybersecurity as a victim of a breach and really changed your life. So where did that take you, and what is the, you know, things we need to start digging into around cybersecurity today?
Well, I put that CEO mindset in place. You know, I've got a decent handle on what my weaknesses are and strengths as a leader. And I'm the majority shareholder, so yeah, I'm the boss until such time as somebody that's better than me can do it, right?
That's good.
So I said, what would I do to address these strengths and weaknesses? I already had a great strategy and a great vision of where I wanted the company to go to. That's one of my gifts of the few. And so I started constructing that and thinking about certain roles in the organization that may not today, but we need to get to where there's a person or a solution for that issue or that role that we need to put in place 2, 3, 5 years down the road. And I started growing the company with that intention at the same time as reestablishing the culture and making it, I hate to use the word proceduralized or formal. I knew I wanted it to be a little bit more professional, but I didn't want to lose, I hate to say the word family because that is so cliche, but I didn't want it to be like that. I just wanted everybody to be comfortable and happy while they're working there. Now, that doesn't mean that that's their end goal. I just wanted it to be a place, you know, that you don't mind coming in and all of that. So I began working it that way. And it's really started to gel, I'd say, in the last 3 years or so. It's really starting to come into play. I've actually reached a point where we don't have any serious missing roles. Now, we still got a lot of work to do, but there's not any serious roles that are missing, and we're addressing a lot of things. We're super client-focused, ethical. Of course, if you're in this business, you got to be ethical and all of that. we continuously run client surveys, and they're all 99, 98% positive. In my whole life, retail management all the way through today, retail management software, I'm talking to small to medium-sized business owners. So I've seen a lot of different scenarios. You know, you could probably walk into an engineering firm, Zach, and you can just feel the vibe. Oh, this is a good vibe. This is a bad vibe. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of tension mm-hmm. around here. You sense those things and you pick up on them. And I really started thinking about that over the years.
So this is really interesting. We framed this like, you know, Tom's this got a zone of genius around cybersecurity. And you came back from your trip. And my first impression, like if I was going to guess what you would say, is like, well, I started digging in and studying and developing new tech around cybersecurity, et cetera, et cetera. But everything that you're talking about so far revolves around setting the culture and leadership and this piece. And that's awesome. But it's also unexpected for the technical focused engineering mind in me. It's like, huh, what's going on there? So connect the dots then. How did you find such an important connection between what the leader at the top is doing versus the actual work and impact that your organization is making in the world right now with cybersecurity and technology?
Well, I was never out on the bleeding edge of technology, like taking code and making it do something that's never been done before, like big data, like Splunk, or a friend of mine, the CEO of Cribble. That's a big, huge data company. He's got that genius in the technological component. My experience has always been, I can find good network engineers. I can find good software engineers. My role is more of a strategic role, right? That technical component is an operational role. And one of the reasons why you establish a really great culture and less tension is you make them excel in their role, in that technical role as an engineer or whatever it may be. That nurtures that resource. And of course, it's a person or, you know, whatever it may be, but it nurtures that resource, and you're setting the scenario. You're setting everything in place to where it's not, as a leader, it's not my fault if it doesn't succeed. And sometimes it is. I have to go back and say, what went wrong here? But I can tell you that as a long-term strategy, and you have to work at it every day, you've got to walk the talk, set the tone at the top. You will get the best out of your people, and they will be the happiest for it. You know, what do engineers want to do? They want to build stuff, or they want to engineer software, or, you know, mechanical engineering, and it's got an art to itself, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you can do the mathematical calculations on whether this beam can handle this load and all of that kind of stuff, but when you put it all together, it's really a thing of beauty. And if you've taken all the stress and the tension and it's well managed, and it just gives them the ability to be free. I guess it's a little bit like going to Venice for a week, right?
There you go. I love that. Yeah. Yeah. Do you think, Tom, that your ability in this way is benefited by not being an engineer in your original training and degree and being able to be separate from the technology in some capacity? Or would you say, you know what, it's really not about that. Anybody can develop and be the kind of leader that you are.
I think anybody can get the training. I think it's a big mistake not to think that you can develop the skills to be a good leader, or especially a good manager. I think managing is much easier for engineers. And I draw that distinction on purpose because, you know, a good manager may not be a part, you know, may not be thinking about culture, but he is making the right business operation moves, right? And hiring the best people and things like that. It gets back to really and truly, management is operations and leadership is strategy. And I kind of forgot what your question was. So
no, I'm just curious if, you know, you have that economics degree that we right out of the gates, like didn't start as a software developer, you know? And so I was just curious, like, is there something there that you think gave you an advantage, or you'd say, no, it really isn't about that?
Maybe because it's a dismal science, it set my expectations so low that I couldn't help but do something else with, you know, just wondering about stuff. I don't know. I really regret it. I went back to school 3 times. My business got in the way, my job got in the way, and I never was able to complete that degree. I'd still love to be writing economics books, and I was fortunate enough to be exposed to some instructors from the Chicago School. And so, these were very talented, probably went on to win Nobel Prizes, but certainly Chicago did, you know. So,
well, so before we were recording today, you said something that I thought was really important. I want to make sure that we give you a chance to share it with the engineering leaders out there listening about how this aspect that you've been describing, how you came back and focused on really leading the strategy, becoming the culture driver, the true CEO, the visionary, and how that type of leadership is essential in cybersecurity decisions and the outcomes that happen in our organizations. So now for every engineering leader out there, it's like, this is why it's so important to become this person and or to encourage your leadership in your organization. So would you describe that relationship that you shared with me earlier and why it's, you know, ultimately the leader's responsibility to protect the organization when it comes to these cybersecurity issues?
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, the vast majority of the population vastly underestimates their risk of being attacked. And some of these attacks are catastrophic. You know, they can put your firm out of business. You could have a week of lost productivity. And so that's my main role in the company, is educating the public through my book and webinars and podcast interviews, all of that. And what I frequently see is, you know, it's real easy to make a management decision to say, okay, I'm convinced we do need to up our cybersecurity game. But then in certain industries, because we cover more than engineering, in certain industries, I see the head guy or the top three partners in an engineering firm, they just exempt themselves. They're exceptions to the security rules. And they're not setting the tone at the top, right?
Mm.
They're going through the motions. So that was a great management decision. And this is where companies, they really end up implementing halfway measures. But when you realize that over 90% of the breaches is because of a non-malicious employee let the hackers into the organization, it's not a technical problem to be solved. You know, we can put all these wonderful new technologies on there to get you to where it's a, you know, 0.00% chance you'll have an attack. And everybody's got their own risk profile. But when you understand that 90% of breaches are a people problem, and you're not setting the tone at the top, you're not really addressing what the vulnerability is. That's the difference between a good leadership and a good manager. One of the many, many things.
Sure.
And that's, I just see it fail so many times that an owner just says, okay, we've got to get better cybersecurity. They'll go to their IT guy, which that's like going to a cardiologist if you need brain surgery. Okay. They're both highly skilled, but they got their specialty. I'm not going to go to a mechanical engineer to build a highway for 50 miles, right? Or design a highway for 50 miles.
Yes.
Okay. So you need to think that way. Cybersecurity versus IT, they truly, truly are two different specialties. And there's a lot of nuances even within those two high-level groups. So what do you do? You know, you get a cancer diagnosis. Are you just going to do whatever the GP says? You know, your primary care provider? No, you're going to go to an oncologist, I hope, or some other specialist that's familiar with that. And that's what makes you a good leader. Once again, it goes back to understanding, in most cases, you don't know what you don't know. And by consulting with skilled people that know it, at least you know more about it and you can understand what the risk to your firm is and the risk to all of your stakeholders. You know, if you get breached, it's not just your firm. It might personally affect your employees, especially if you go out of business, but what if their medical records get stolen? You may be a threat vector for whoever you're working for, who the vendor is. You know, if you work for state or federal government or Fortune 500 company, whatever it may be, you could end up causing them a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really just the cost of doing business, but more importantly, it's just the right thing to do. You have to think, and if there's another thing that I like to talk about is stakeholder capitalism. Things have changed in the last 20, 30 years, as society always does. Sometimes it stays the same too, but you know, it's really more of a stakeholder capitalism environment. It's no longer shareholder capitalism. It's not about the shareholders, and that's the number one thing. Like, who's at risk here? You don't want to forget
anybody. Interesting perspective. You mentioned, hey, we grossly underestimate the risk, and you're hitting on some of the things that can happen if a breach does occur. And I think especially for engineering leaders, we can wrap our heads around that. But would you just share a little bit about this underestimating? Like, what is the real risk? I don't know if stats are just explaining how to reframe really what's happening out there when it comes to data breaches and or other forms of cybersecurity attacks. Like, what is the risk?
You have to understand there's thousands and thousands of cyber attacks on the United States every single day. And the vast majority of attacks are not targeted attacks. Now, Colonial Pipeline, that was a targeted attack. JBS, that was a targeted attack. But the majority of them, and probably most of the listeners, but it doesn't matter if you're a Fortune 10 company, okay? Ford Motor Company, JBS, they're all vulnerable. And they're more prone to a targeted attack. But the majority of them are done by bots, and they're done at scale. It's a one-to-many con. They're blasting out 100,000 phishing emails. We do a lot of work with law firms. They're blasting out 100,000 phishing emails to everybody that's a member of the New York State Bar Association, okay? All they're thinking about is conversion rates. Well, man, if just 1% pays a ransom of average of $10,000, that's a $10 million payday. Just 1% wow. conversion rate. They never even know or care who's paying the ransom. At no point. The whole systems are automated. So when you really understand the scale of it and the randomness of it, and then you add the whole cyber warfare component, the nation state issue to it, it makes you realize that it doesn't matter who or where or what size you are, it can happen to you. We know that when I do webinars, on average, about 20% of the people respond positively to the question, have you or someone you know personally been a victim of a ransomware attack? About 20% always answer yes.
Wow.
Sometimes it's 10, sometimes it's 30, but that's usually true across all industries. So it goes vastly underreported, number one.
Yes.
And then I just see it all the time. I can't tell you how many people that we've brought on as clients that's been a ransomware victim two, three times, and they're just then convinced, even if they've heard me speak.
Oh, wow.
After doing it three times, they are then convinced that they need to get serious about it.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So most engineering leaders are familiar with the general idea of cybersecurity and what's going on here, but I don't think it's been focal point, to your point, the oncologist versus the cardiologist kind of conversation. So I wish we could go all day on really get into the details. You're kind of geeking me out. We're just now getting to the juicy technology bits here. But tell us, where would we begin? Maybe I'm not the CEO. I'm not the leader making the sweeping decisions for the organization. But what are the first building blocks that we all need to take into account as we look at this problem and how to solve it in our companies and in our lives?
Well, Zach, you mentioned that you're not the CEO. So, but I do want to say that if you are the CEO, you have to get this basics of knowledge of the true scope of the risk. You've got to understand what the risk to the firm is, because when the 6 o'clock news comes knocking on the door wondering why this $500 million engineering firm suffered a major breach that's building some sort of $10 billion project, you're the guy that's going to have to explain it. Now, we deal with CIOs and IT directors because they understand they don't have the skills and the expertise, and they're not really familiar with the dark parts of the internet and all of the different ways that you can be exploited and conned and manipulated, engineered, socially engineered, right? Mm-hmm. And they don't have time to learn it because they've got to keep everything running. They've got an IT job and they just treat it as a role, right? Now, as an individual, be more cognizant of just little simple things like don't reuse credentials. 90% of the population uses the same set of credentials on their email as they use on their bank account, as they use on Facebook. Well, if any one of those gets hacked, they're all compromised potentially. Because yeah. The first thing a criminal hacker that specializes in that hack, the first thing they do when they get a set of credentials for anybody, and this is all done at scale and automated too, by the way, is they start hitting Chase Bank, Citi Bank. It may be a set of email credentials, but they automate these attacks on Chase to see if they can get into the bank account or to get into Facebook or mm-hmm. vice versa. We're seeing a big increase in business email compromises where they've gotten into your email and they can impersonate, you know, yeah. and say, you're sending yeah. an invoice out for $150,000. Here's the banking information. They will intercept that email, change the bank account and routing number, and the money will end up going to the wrong place. And now they're it. And that's a bad place to be in if you're a business and you've accidentally wired it to the wrong account number and wrong bank.
Yeah, big time. So, I mean, Thomas, if somebody's feeling like I'm feeling like, hey, okay, I'm hungry to get some information here. Like, where do we begin? What's the places, the resources to, you know, maybe we're not going to become cybersecurity gurus overnight. But what would you encourage someone to do first if they want to take action on what you've shared with us here?
Well, I don't have any intentions of becoming a civil engineer overnight either. You just don't. No one person has the ability to be an expert in everything. The more you learn, the less you know. Totally. Hopefully you feel that way. The more you learn, the less you know.
True story.
And I mean, if you're going to get serious, you really need to engage like an iron tech company, a managed security services provider. Don't think the IT firm, if you're outsourcing your IT to, say, an MSP or even your own staff, don't think that they fully comprehend things like a NIST cybersecurity framework. They don't know the latest EDRs. And I know I'm throwing out acronyms that you may not know, but these are the telltale. This is how when I talk to an IT staff, I go, what are the top two EDRs and why? Or have you ever done a NIST compliance assessment? Generally speaking, no. They just don't work in that part of the industry enough to even understand it. It's not do-it-yourself any longer.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just not. You've got to go to the experts to really understand it. And you can just engage them with advice. You can get a vulnerability scan done on your network. You can cut your risk in half to your entire firm if you implement continuous cybersecurity awareness for everyone in the firm. That'll cut your risk in half.
Wow.
50% of your risk is gone.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I like it. It connects to what you said earlier, what 90% of these breaches are people problems, not technology problems. So that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. But then you got to remember, you've still got the people problem because these guys that do the psychological manipulation, they're good. You know, the days of broken English, misspelled words, bad graphics on these emails, I get a chuckle when I see one because they're so rare anymore. I mean, they can fool me. You know, we simulate phishing attacks in our company every week, and there's only one person that's got 100% score, and I'm not him or her.
Oh, wow.
I've been fooled, and it's something that just, I'll be working on my Google security settings, and it just so happens that I get one of these simulated phishing emails that saying, hey, your Google security settings changed. And I'll click on it. And the next thing, I've got a 2-minute training video on why I fell for it.
Oh, my goodness. I'm inspired by that. And truly, if you know, humbled by the reality. Like here, Tom is operating in his zone of genius in cybersecurity and still falls for the attack. So I think we all need to take that seriously. And I'll say it, you know, shameless plug for Iron Tech and Tom's organization, but you do engage with a professional for the engineering leader out there, or ask your CIO, your leaders to make sure that they're taking the appropriate action with the appropriate specialists in this way. That's amazing. Tom, I know if we could go all day. You have a wealth of both wisdom and experience to share with us. But to wrap it up for now, until next time, You know, I always end in the same place. What you've shared really aligns with the fact that, you know, great engineering, great coaching, great leadership has in common that we want to ask better questions if we want to get better answers in life. So let's ask great questions. And I'm curious for you, if that engineering leader who's been hearing this conversation, you know, really does want to lead well, make a big impact, and, you know, make great decisions, what would be the question you would lead them with today?
I think you got to look backwards too. You got to do a, what we call in the industry a postmortem. And what went wrong? What were the defense mechanisms that failed? And all 90% is going to be a human that failed. But then there may be technical defensive controls, or maybe the response by the security team could have been better. And then to learn from those mistakes, because you're constantly uncovering weaknesses in your own organization and maybe even others that you can help them with. What went wrong? Whenever something does go wrong, and it always does, you spend time and reflect on what went wrong and fix it. That's it.
Powerful. I love that, Tom, because it's not just for our cybersecurity issues. That's a anything in life question. What?
Yeah, I'll tell you this. If you ask that question to your team and they get defensive about it, you've got two things wrong. You've got whatever it is that you're talking about, but your culture and your tone is not set right, because you're not the culture itself is not going to be able to honestly apprise the situation and say, this was my failure, or we didn't have the right procedures over here, or it was an external vendor. I mean, and you don't want to do it with excuses. It's real easy to say, oh, it was an external vendor. Well, why didn't we intercept that? It's like a plane crash. There's 7 or 10 or 15 different things that all conspired together to crash the plane. There's always a chain that can always be improved.
I love it. Tom, thanks so much for this. And I know the engineering leaders out there who've been listening are going to want to connect with you and get more information, maybe reach out to Iron Tech. So where can we go if we want to understand more about you and the amazing work you're doing?
Well, the website's real easy, irontechsecurity.com. Just like it sounds, all one word. My personal website is tomkirkham.com, and I do speaking engagements and keynotes and things like that, if you guys, any of you, are part of an engineering society. And you can sign up to be notified of my books. But yeah, if cybersecurity is your deal, go to irontechsecurity.com. But there's tons and tons of resources you can implement today at no cost that are best. These are industry standards, international standards, ISO and COBIT-5 and CIS and all these other standards out there.
Awesome.
Protecting organizations is not a mystery to me, because there are best practices. And it's not because I say you need to do this. It's because NIST or ISO standards or whatever it may be, just like it is in engineering.
Awesome. I hope everybody will take action on that quickly. Go out, check out Tom, check out Iron Tech and their work, Tom's books, etc. All those links will be in the show notes. You know where to find those. You can click there on your device or go to thehappyengineerpodcast.com. Tom, thanks again for making time for this. It's been awesome.
Yeah, thank you, Zach. I really enjoyed it. You do an excellent job, and just keep it up.
If you're an engineer and you want to be happier, healthier, and wealthier in your career and life, we would love to talk to you. In other episodes, I explain a bit more, but all you need to know is that I've carved out a limited number of $500 coaching sessions just for podcast listeners for free to gain extreme clarity on your current career blocks and barriers and to determine your personal action plan. Grab a time while they're still available on careerclaritycall.com. That's in the show notes. Click the big orange button, pick a time to chat for 15 minutes with one of our coaches, and they'll take care of the rest. Let's do this. Whoa, seriously? An ISIS kill list? Having the FBI come knocking on your door, letting you know that ISIS wants to kill you? That's pretty intense. This conversation reminded me of an NCIS episode or something like that. So what I want to talk to you about here as we debrief together and think about action in your own life is, what do we do in these pivotal moments, these pivotal moments of life. But really quick before I go there, I do want to address the idea of technology and cybersecurity and a little bit of the engineering hat on. It was fun to geek out on some of those points with Tom, and it may be something that's rolling around in your mind because we covered a lot in this conversation. I just want to say one thing. Regardless of your role, your title, the focus that you have within your company, just be careful of that ego of intellect getting in the way in approaching problems like this from, again, a place of ego rather than a place of humility and leadership. And here's the key thing. You might be tempted, like I am in life as an engineer myself, to always want to become smarter and figure out how things work. You may have heard some of the compelling reasons why cybersecurity needs more attention in your own life at home, in your company, and thinking to yourself, what do I need to learn and how can I solve this problem for myself or my company? Well, please, please, please remember to first ask who before how. This is a really important principle in all of leadership, asking who before how. As engineering leaders, we love to solve that problem of how to get things done. We are how-minded leaders. And so it's super important that we get into the habit of asking who before how. Who can help you solve this problem? Who has already solved this problem before you? Who can provide the expertise and the solution so that you can focus on what is uniquely your zone of genius? And whether it's Tom's organization or any other who provides like services, the key here I just want you to remember is that as an engineering leader, it is not your job to be the expert in all things. It is your job to lead. It is your job to be a genius in the area where only you can add that unique value and to help extract the best out of the people on your team. If you're at the bottom of the org chart, you're an individual contributor. That's okay. This doesn't change. You still want to begin asking those questions. Who has already solved this? Who can help me? Who can mentor me? Who can coach me? Who can help me solve the problem? Before you bury yourself into hours and hours and hours of textbooks or blog articles or GitHubs or things to go figure it out on your own, practice asking who before how. All right, let's come back to this idea of pivotal moments in life, because I think it's so important. And maybe you are experiencing a pivotal moment in your life right now. I know several of my clients are. One of my clients works at a startup that failed to secure funding for their next round, and suddenly he's out of a job. My best friend recently lost his father to cancer sooner than expected, and they thought he was doing well and recovering, and then overnight, next thing you know, his dad has died. And, you know, the death of a parent or a close loved one is something, you know, you're never prepared for. Nothing gets you ready for that. I think about my own story, being divorced and experiencing depression in my career and coming out of that situation and just wondering, well, what am I going to do next? How does this change my future and who I am and what I want? And, you know, divorce was a big part of my story and what led me to burnout and frustration in my career. I think about my amazing wife. Before we even started dating, she was diagnosed with a brain tumor. Completely changed her world. Flipped everything upside down. And she's been really courageous to share that story and experienced a miraculous healing, but that was a pivotal moment in her life. What is that pivotal moment in your story right now? Maybe you've gone through one recently, or maybe you feel one coming. Regardless, the question I like to get curious about with everyone who I coach is, what do we fall back on when we hit those pivotal moments? You know, what are the things that you automatically default to when you're under immense stress or pressure, or you feel that sense of depression and burnout in your life, when everything's falling apart and overwhelming and you don't feel like you have any control over the situation and it's just really, really painful or just absolutely unspeakable what's going on, or just a total surprise and deep uncertainty and fear that rises up, you're in a pivotal moment in your life. For Tom, it was the FBI walking in and telling him you're on an ISIS kill list. And it was that straw that broke the camel's back for him after already going through cancer and the spinal infection and the things he told us about, like, wow, pivotal moment. Well, what do you fall back on when you hit one of those pivotal moments in your life? And the answer is the values, the beliefs, and the mindsets that you have been using since childhood to protect you and keep you safe. You default back to those survival instincts. And here's the problem. While those things are good, and they've gotten you through life to this point, and they've served you and provided value from a young age all the way to today, the problem is that your survival instincts are not success instincts. Staying alive and staying safe, and the behaviors and patterns that you have developed over your lifetime to stay safe, are not the patterns, the actions, the habits, the behaviors that are going to lead you to success. Your automatic systems when under pressure, when under stress, when facing challenge, are not wired to help you thrive. They're wired to help you survive. And in my 90-day Lifestyle Engineering Blueprint program, we talk about this so much because learning how to reprogram your subconscious, learning how to build new habits, learning how to take the unconscious values and beliefs and mindsets that you hold today and make them conscious, and to discover whether or not those values are actually serving the life that you want to create. Are they going to take you forward in the way and in the trajectory that you want for your life? Being able to do that, to discover your purpose in a way that's actionable, in a way that you can make decisions that aligns with that purpose. Learning how to discover your own values in a way that is meaningful and actually creates clarity and this compass for the direction you want to take your life, even when you're in a pivotal moment, so that you're not unconsciously following a set of values and beliefs that are not serving you, but you are consciously following the rules and the values that you hold that are going to take you forward toward your vision. This is such a fundamental part of our coaching program because the truth is you are going to experience pressure. Not every moment will be as pivotal as FBI walking in and telling you ISIS wants to kill you, but you're going to have a pivotal moment in your career this week. Could be a key conversation with your boss. It could be a big presentation and an opportunity to show the leadership of your organization, your ideas and your capabilities, your ability to influence and to present with power and presence. It could be you've got a conflict with one of the other members on your team, and you need to go have that courageous, crucial conversation to deal with that conflict and get back to a working, effective relationship with that person. You're going to have these smaller but still pivotal moments. And when you get there, if you don't have the mindsets, the skill sets, the tool sets to actually step into that with a success mindset instead of a survival mindset, then when you're under pressure, you're going to default back to the same patterns and behaviors that you've been using your whole life. And I think it's so, so important that we do not wait for the rock bottom moment. We do not wait for the pivotal, painful moment of our life to take action on this. You can proactively design the lifestyle, engineer the mindsets and the lifestyles that you desire for your future. You can create that vision, actually become an agent of change in your own journey if you take those steps before the rock bottom moment. And it's so sad when I see people who could have made change years and years earlier wait until the pain is just so much that they feel they have no other option. So my challenge to you is to ask yourself, what am I doing proactively now to be ready for the next pivotal moment, whatever that is, that the way that I'll respond will absolutely take me forward towards my purpose, vision, and values that I do want, and not wait until I unconsciously respond in a way that does not serve me and end up in a rock bottom burnout place. This is what lifestyle engineering is all about. This is, I think about the first three modules of our program and what our clients go through. And it's this absolutely brilliant and powerful discovery process that for so many, they say, oh my goodness, I wish I had done this years ago, because there's so many decisions I've made that I would have made differently. Tom said it in this interview, and a lot of people don't like this idea, but I think he brings up a really important point that we all have regrets. We're lying to ourselves if we say we don't have any. It's totally fine to say I wouldn't change anything about my life because the regrets that I have and the things that did not go my way have brought me to this point and I would not change it. I trust the process of life. But we all have those regrets. Are you learning from them? And are you setting yourself up now to not have the big regrets in the future when those pivotal moments come? Awesome conversation with Tom. I hope you're encouraged and challenged. And if there's any way that we can support you here with the Happy Engineer community, jump in, join our private Facebook group. It's totally free. Get in there, start sharing what's going on for you. What questions do you have? Where do you feel blocked? Where do you feel stuck in your career? We're gonna start doing free training more often. We're gonna start bringing more value. I wanna get in there and help you. Please join us. It's gonna be awesome. And above all, keep crushing comfort, create courage, and let's do this. My friend, that's all we've got for this episode of the Happy Engineer Podcast. Thank you again for investing your time with me today. If you're like me, then maybe you'll take some notes and share this episode with your fellow engineers. Why? Because it will help you learn deeper, remember these insights, and take action. So share this episode with two or three friends just like you who are committed to building their career. Lastly, make sure to link up with us at oasisofcourage.com. Grab our free tools for career growth there in the resource hub and schedule a free call with our coaching team today. Please just share this podcast with anyone who you think might enjoy it. Until next time, remember to crush comfort, create courage, and let's do this.